This is the summer to expand your horizons. You've had enough staying home. You've had enough confinement. It's time to explore. But before you set foot out the door, set foot in the ultimate travel shoes from Allbirds, like the breathable, silky, smooth tree runner, the responsive foam and extra grip of the tree dasher, or the classic low-top look of the tree piper. Allbirds has a shoe ready for whatever adventures you have planned. Whether you're traveling to the ends of the earth or settling in for a staycation, you need a shoe that's versatile enough to go with any outfit, durable enough to wear over any terrain, and lightweight enough to make packing a breeze. Being made from insanely comfortable, breezy eucalyptus fiber is a plus, too. When you wear Allbirds tree shoes, you're in vacation mode before you even leave the house. They're the only shoes your suitcase needs. Boarding pass? Check. Passport? Check. The perfect travel shoe? Check. Find your perfect pair of tree dashers, runners, pipers, and more at Allbirds.com. That's Allbirds.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right. Hello, everyone. This is Daniel from the Cannonball here with a, well, we have a special treat for y'all. This is kind of a, I guess, a bonus addition to some of the usual output that we do. And we're really thrilled about it. This is for, of course, the Agora Network. We have sponsorships, and we've had a really special one in the last few months. If you've been listening to the show, of course, we have been talking about the online Great Books program. And so I'm really very thrilled to be able to share with y'all one of the leading lights of online Great Books is here to talk to yours truly. Claude actually had to sit this one out due to some technical slash baby slash who knows what kind of issues, but I think mostly technical. So it's just going to be me and Scott here talking, but we have a really cool show lined up for y'all because I think really because online Great Books lines up so well with what we do on the Cannonball that we just had to have like an actual kind of, I don't know, a sit down chat about some great books with someone from online Great Books. So Scott Hambrick is here. And Scott, if you could please tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and a little bit about what online Great Books is about.
Well, you've already said my name. I'm Scott Hambrick, and I own OnlineGreatBooks.com. I've spent a lot of time as a small business person and, you know, doing business-to-business, kind of small business, and kind of semi-retired from that now. And I've always been interested in the great books and run a great books group out of my home for years. And a friend of mine, Brett McKay, who owns and runs The Art of Manliness, he's in my home group, and he's like, Hambrick, you've got to get this out so more people can do it. You know, we need to get this, you know, in some sort of online environment. So I did. We have, you know, hundreds of people reading, you know, books from the classical Greek era right now. They've signed up. We send them their books directly to their home. We send them reading reminders, text message reading reminders. We try to help people create a habit of reading the good stuff for 3 hours a week. And then we, in the Great Books tradition, we have a two-hour Socratic seminar that one of our seminar hosts leads, and we have just normal people. You know, we've got everybody from surgeons to the towel boy at the car wash, literally, that are discussing, you know, the Iliad and Plato's Protagoras and, you know, books of the Western canon. And our list is a whole lot like Bloom's list. they overlap 90%. So we're reading a lot of the books you guys are reading, and. Man, it's just, you know, I've had people email me and say, you know, thank you so much. I can't believe it. I just finished the Iliad, and it's the first book I've ever read.
Yeah.
you know, so we're really getting regular people to read these things that I think that everybody should know, you know, should own in their head.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's one of the great, overlaps between our two projects. Yours, of course, is much more organized and noble and getting it out there than ours. But I think that idea that these are works that belong to everyone. And so it's important for people to avail themselves of them. I think what's really cool about what y'all do is providing that sort of that, not only by providing the, you know, the selected editions that you actually, so as part of your subscription, not only do you get the reminders and the Socratic dialogue stuff, you actually get the actual books, you know, sent to you.
Yeah.
And that kind of structure that's provided by that kind of sort of accountability to yourself and your fellow students, really helps provide a lot of that structure and helps people accomplish, you know, reading these on the face of them pretty intimidating works. I mean, before you actually grapple with them. I mean, when we were starting out, when Claude first pitched it to me, you know, to do the Cannonball, like I'm the layman of the two of us. And I was a little bit like, I don't know, am I up to the task? But having that kind of accountability to another person that you're involved in the project with is just such an important aspect of actually being, sort of giving yourself the self-discipline, teaching yourself the discipline to actually, to read and stuff. And then honestly, I'll tell y'all, once you actually get into reading these books, I mean, there's a reason why they've, you know, stood the test of time as interesting works you can get stuff out of. You know, like, there's really, it's amazing just how gripping it can be. So that's really awesome, Scott, that that y'all are have this program out there that's reaching so many people. And we'll talk a little bit more, I think, after our kind of conversation here I'll go ahead and put it at the top here. Y'all actually do have a promotion going via our podcast, you know, the Cannonball, you know, through Agora, so yeah. That there's actually a promo code that, so if y'all are listening and this sounds like up your alley, which I would presume a lot of our listeners absolutely would be.
I'm going to interrupt you.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of podcasts, talking about great books and talking about these big ideas in these books. And I'm going to indict all of your listeners that are listening to us. I think that a lot of times people listen to podcasts about these heady things. Mm-hmm. And for them, that suffices for actually reading them and knowing those books in their head.
I think you're right. And I'll be the first to tell them, man, listen to me blather on about the Divine Comedy is nowhere close to the experience of reading it. not by a long shot.
No, the conversation we're going to have about Burke here ain't even the shadow on the cave wall.
That's right.
So you've got to, you know, I listen to the podcast too. I listen to audiobooks. I listen to the, you know, what is it? The great courses, mm-hmm. you know, the teaching companies.
Yeah. Stuff.
But all of it pales to, you know, we're actually picking up one of these books that you and Claude work through and actually doing that for yourself. You know, mm-hmm. You can only touch just a little bit of it in this audio format.
Oh, yeah.
And so they get the fullness of the thing if they actually do it themselves. Plus, they get the accomplishment. You know, when it's done, you can look at that giant book that you read and see the notes and the margins, mm-hmm. and you did it. You know, yeah. It's a big deal.
Absolutely. And it is a big deal. I can tell you from experience, like I felt very accomplished actually reading these things. And so, yeah, you're absolutely right, man. Like it's, you know, listening to some other people talk about it is nowhere close to the actual, you know, the cognitive experience of, you know, reading a text for yourself, encountering these thoughts from another human being from, you know, X number of years ago. And it's this widely differing and disparate civilizations and ways of and modes of being. There is no substitute for it. So yeah, if that sounds like something that you'll want to be a part of, you can sign up for online great books. And I believe there's a promo code for Cannonball listeners, which is CAN. Is that correct, Scott?
Yes, sir.
All right.
Yeah. So you go to onlinegreatbooks.com and you click on join now. And when you go to check out, if you enter in that promo code CAN, you'll get 25% off your first 3 months. If perchance you go there and enrollment's closed, you can go and join the waiting list. Mm-hmm. And then when you check in, you'll still get that discount. And the next enrollment will be open October 15th, 2018. And then the one after that will be January 1st, 2019.
Fantastic. Yeah. So keep that in your calendars, y'all. And to sort of move on to the meat of this, and give y'all a taste of what you're in store with for for reading the great
let's
books.
Let's wrestle.
Let's wrestle, man. So we picked out a couple of texts, which, actually, I think when the idea was first floated, Scott, you suggested that you wanted to talk about Edmund Burke and the reflections on the French Revolution, kind of his most famous work, the one that tends to be most cited to the present day. And so you were like, well, and what would you like to talk about? And I thought to myself, I've never read the only Voltaire I had ever actually read cover to cover had been Candide, and it's a short and easy one, and it's a great one. It's a great work. So I thought to myself, we have the Englishman writing about the French. Let us have the Frenchman writing about the English. So I went with Voltaire's Letters on the English, which I had read excerpts from back in college. And I thought to myself, that's one that I want to dive a little more into. And so that was my assignment for Scott, was Voltaire here. And Letters on the English is an interesting work. And it's also a very, I don't want to call it a bathroom reader, but you could totally use it as a bathroom reader, because it really is these very, it's these succinct pieces. They were literally sort of letters that it was, that he intended to be published. It wasn't exactly personal correspondence, but it was correspondence. So it tends to be, rather pithy, but it's Voltaire. This is when he was living in, and the heat had gotten a little too much on him for criticizing the French system of government. And so he hopped across the channel to stay in England for a while until the 5-0 was off his, right, off his scent. And this was between, I want to say it's in the 1720s. Yeah. He was writing in the 1720s. And so it wasn't published until but it wasn't published until the 1730s. I want to say 1733. Yeah, there it is in my notes. So this is, a generation before, Burke's writing, but I still feel like they're kind of, and they were contemporaries. Their times did overlap, so it's not exactly contemporaneous, but I still, it's in the same kind of wheelhouse. So I guess my question to you, Scott, is, what kind of impression did Voltaire's Letters on the English leave to you? Or I guess I should say, I'm sorry, before I get into that impression, I should say that, sort of the content of the letters is, for the first part, Voltaire is commenting upon the religious situation in England. Specifically, he's very interested in the dissenting factions or the dissenting denominations. At this time in England, there's, of course, the established Church of England, the Anglican Church. And anyone who did not, there were a number of denominations and sects that didn't comport with the Church of England, and they were known as dissenters. And this includes things like the Quakers, or I guess a little later on you would get Methodists and Baptists, but there were some other sects there. And so later on he talks about, Voltaire's writing letters about the Parliament, the system of government that the English have, on trade. And then I think very interestingly, and fitting with his sort of Enlightenment polymath persona, his Enlightenment polymath reputation, he writes a lot about the great advances in science that are going on in England at the time, because this is also around the time that Sir Isaac Newton is at his most active. So that's kind of the broad outline of what's going on in the letters. And Scott, what jumped out at you most? What left the biggest impression, Voltaire here in his letters for you?
Well, first I read the Penguin Classics, Voltaire Letters on England, old paperback here, in case I give any page numbers or anything anybody cares to follow. Man, I thought he was great fun. I think calling it bathroom readings, right?
Yeah.
It flows. It's fun. It's almost like reading Mark Twain.
Mm-hmm. He's
really funny, and he's not scared to put his finger in somebody's eye. Nothing's off the board, whether it's religion or individual politicians or Newton. I mean, nothing's off the table for this guy, and he's just smart and funny. It is, they're letters. They're short pieces. Mm-hmm. They're all self-contained. They're very interesting and fun, and it kind of reads like a travel diary. Also, it's a delight to read. We're not even talking about the ideas in it yet, but it's a delight to read. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
He was fascinated by even though England had a state religion, he was fascinated by their religious freedom and the types of religious characters that were there. Mm-hmm. And he starts off talking about the Quakers, who are you know, we know what the Quaker stereotype is, right? It's the guy on the oatmeal box.
Right. And that's kind of the basically the end of most people's knowledge of the Quakers as an expression of the Christian religion, really. It's like we think of the guy on the oatmeal can and like, oh yeah, and I think maybe Pennsylvania has something to do with it.
Right. Yeah, just these staid, sober people. And he wrote about them very admiringly, you know. And I think that even though those were people were Quakers and they weren't, you know, the predominant, you know, members of the predominant sect, the Anglicans, they're very English, you know, in their sort of hierarchical, even though they are they do like lay preaching and stuff. But they're very proper. They have excellent work ethic. They're ambitious people who take care of their own business. And he portrays them as very English people. It's great. And then when he talks about the Anglican clergy, I mean, they're certainly very English too. He says that an Englishman as a free man can go to heaven by whatever route he likes. So they're not, even though they have a state religion, he says, you know, that they're actually pretty forgiving and pretty tolerant of those other sects.
He says that
the clergy in England are almost all married. Then he says, the uncouth manner they have acquired in the university and the lack of feminine society there means that usually a bishop has to make do with his own wife in England.
That's one thing I really love about Voltaire is the, especially in this Letters on the English, because of course his audience is back at home, right? He's writing these for a French audience. And so he's like, it's almost like the kind of, it's like that other kind of Enlightenment trope of the noble savage, where the writer picks a presumed to be more primitive society than his own in order to, you know, exemplify them, to point out all the hypocrisies and corruption of his own society. I think Rousseau among the French was kind of the most, you know, leaned on that the most. And I think it was kind of funny that Voltaire sort of used the English as his noble savages in that rhetorical space, you know, to contrast.
I think Burke would take exception there.
Well, yes, of course, as we all should. The whole stereotypical idea of the noble savage is one that we need to actually, you know, it's not that great.
He's certainly looking at England as a laboratory for some ideas that the French could possibly learn from. You know, in this letter on the Presbyterians, he says, if there were only one religion in England, there would be a danger of despotism. If there were two, they'd cut each other's throats. But there are 30, and they live in peace and happiness. And you know, they're having big problems with corruption in the Catholic Church in France at this time. So he's really interested in how all of these weird sects, including Catholics, aren't warring in the streets all over the English Isle.
And
he manages to talk about it and still be fun, unlike Burke. There's nothing fun about Burke.
No, Burke is dead serious all the time. Burke is the, he's your crazy uncle. He's the guy who's always like stepped into the thread like, hey, too much fun going on here. All right, this is serious discussion time. What I thought was interesting with Voltaire, especially on religion, especially with the Quakers, is that you really get the sense, like kind of the stereotype of Voltaire is that he was kind of unendingly hostile to organized religion. And that shows up a little bit in some of these letters and some, you know, some asides here and there. But what I think, especially as talking to the Quakers, he seemed pretty fascinated with the idea of like you mentioned, the lay preaching. Like there was a much more egalitarian sense, at least in worship with the Quakers. Like you mentioned, like the Quakers themselves are still very tied up in the English class system. These weren't the levelers or the diggers of a century earlier, where there was some sort of radical experiments in England with a more sort of radical definition of egalitarianism. But they did take seriously this idea of egalitarianism within the body of the faithful, and I think that really struck a chord with Voltaire. I think it highlights that Voltaire was more anti-clerical than anti-faith, we might say. Like he himself was, you know, he was in that mold of he's kind of the prototypical Enlightenment deist. Like his conception of what the divine is was that it was very removed from our day-to-day life, that there was basically, like an Aristotelian prime mover, was kind of as far as he was willing to go for saying this is what I think, you know, God might be. But I think that's what I found most interesting. And that's what kind of jumped out at me the most in the, at least the story of that first part of the letters on the English, is how he seemed legitimately very interested in these people's self-conception and these people's ways of going about things in a way that the kind of, I don't know, you might imagine a kind of snide and self-satisfied atheist today might not go about it.
right.
But that really jumped out at me. Like, I think it's, you know, I think Voltaire as a man is much more, he's much more upset with the abuses of a religious hierarchy than with the idea of religion itself.
Yeah, when he goes to the Quaker meeting and he sees the lay preaching, you know, they call themselves the Friends. Mm-hmm. And when he sees that, I can imagine that he's having these prototypical thoughts about the rights of men and this equality that later crops up in their bloody violent revolution.
Right. That Burke has some things to say about too.
Yeah. But you can see the beginnings of it.
Yeah.
I think he's generous. He can be biting and ugly sometimes to his opponents, but mm-hmm. he's not here. I think he has a love for the English, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. And it really, I think one of the one ways it really shines through is in his really just truly. I don't know if this is the right word to use, but I was almost touched by how excited he was to report about Isaac Newton. Like,
oh yeah,
like it's really, you get this kind of secondhand excitement from him, because he wrote this whole letter, the letter 15 on attraction. So he's talking about Isaac Newton's universal gravitation, his theory of universal gravitation mm-hmm. or attraction, and just the way he talks about it, he has that same kind of like almost like schoolboy excitement about like the way that this is, you know, like, oh wow, like Isaac really cracked into something here. And it's one of those things you can read that, like, history of science is something that I'm pretty interested in myself, that I've done, and again, of the many things I'm a layperson in, science is way up there. Like, I'm a humanities man through and through. Don't ask me to actually do any science, but I'm still interested in like the history of the sort of the philosophical bases and the ways in which the body of knowledge developed, right? And it can be hard to capture. It can be hard to access the kind of excitement that must have been going on in people's minds with each of these sort of great steps, like, you know, like Galileo reporting that there were satellites around Jupiter, you know, or Einstein's, you know, theory of general relativity upending the Newtonian universe, etc. So that's what's pretty neat about, you know, reading a primary source from this time of these great strides being made in this understanding of the material universe by someone who is very interested in that topic. And he's getting me all hyped about it. Like, you read it.
Yeah.
And like, you know, at least for me, it was like, I started sort of getting that secondhand excitement that, like, wow, that must have, you know, no wonder it sort of gave a window into that enlightenment, like the sort of enlightenment thinkers that really took it to the extreme with, like, okay, using reason, we can absolutely figure everything out. And of course, you know, that's a project that's doomed to failure, but you can almost understand why they felt that way when you understand that, like, oh, wait a minute, there were guys that really were cracking the code on some stuff. Like, I would get caught up in the excitement too.
Yeah. I don't think there'll ever be anything else happens like those discoveries that mm-hmm. Newton made. I don't think that we can even, the internet ain't that. Landing on the moon isn't that.
No, you know? Yeah, landing on the moon was just the fulfillment of Newton, really. It was just like taking Newton did and running with it.
I mean, since maybe some guy was able to start and control fire, it's probably the biggest deal. And Voltaire was there.
Yeah.
And you know, and he writes about that with all the excitement as somebody who might, you know, actually gotten to go to the moon maybe with it. And he writes about Descartes and Newton, and he kind of you know, compares and contrasts those people. And then later on he craps on the Royal Society, you know, the science society in London that mm-hmm. Newton was a member of, and Faraday, and all these giants, because anybody could join.
Yeah, yeah.
And the French societies weren't like that. And he's both super excited about all of those innovations that are coming from Newton and minds like that, but at the same time, he doesn't really get it.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't get that there was this that there's this lay scientific and technological movement in England that will change the world forever. Like, he's excited about the ideas, but he doesn't understand that this idea that the Quakers will have this lay-led preaching is actually the same as James Watt working on steam engines and Newton with, you know, a candle and paper mm-hmm. unlocking the secrets of the universe. It's a democratic project mm-hmm. in England. And Voltaire's not quite ready for that yet, I don't think. He doesn't quite get
it. Yeah, it's and you know, whether that's a matter of like, you know, I'm not of a much of a Voltairist to know, but I would be curious to know whether that was... whether that could be more of a reflection of just the kind of the hard-coded Frenchness, if you're raised in it, it's hard to look outside of it. Or was there some sort of in his system of thought that he developed, did that not have a place for that kind of more radically democratized notion of participation and participation isn't quite the word I'm looking for.
It's just an entrepreneurial spirit in thought, in deed,
in
everything, you know?
Yeah.
These British at this time are remarkable people. Not that the French weren't as well. But Voltaire clearly is, and some of those thinkers, Rousseau,
I think you're right. There's definitely an energy going on in England that, you know, of course, you know, there are reams and reams to be written on, you know, topics such as, say, the cause of the Industrial Revolution, which is in itself, you know, if you're looking for the cause, you're already barking down the wrong path. But I think you're right, though, that there's something specific happening in the British Isles that is a kind of combination of these material and cultural and intellectual threats that Voltaire is, you're right, he's kind of plucking at, but he can't quite grasp the implications of it. I guess he won't live to see the full sort of mm-hmm. that fully bear fruit in this, in the terms of the kind of global hegemony that this island will achieve, for good or ill, for a lot of the places that felt the brunt of it. But still, like, you know, it's a remarkable brew is happening there. Yeah. And I guess that makes a good segue into our English thinker that we're talking about, Edmund Burke.
Crusty Uncle Edmund.
Crusty Uncle Ed, man, who is there. He's also there in the cockpit. He's watching it happen, but he's also watching what's happening to Voltaire's France as the kinds of contradictions and the riven society and the hidebound society that had been barely kept together in Voltaire's day has exploded in the French Revolution, which is itself, you know, we could sit here all day talking about the causes and ramifications of the French Revolution. But we're specifically going to be talking about what Edmund Burke saw in it. And this is, it's a fascinating work that I'd never, I guess to sort of give kind of my personal history with this text. Up until reading this for my conversation with you, Scott, I'd only ever read Burke in kind of summary or epitome, or I had read excerpts, like sort of extended excerpts, but still only an excerpt.
People who hate Edmund Burke.
There are, and I will say, to put my cards on the table, it's usually been in the mode of explicating the. I've normally read Burke in the sense of someone is arguing against someone else who's claiming Burke as some sort of foundation or forebear. And so that's one reason I was really, really interested to get at the, and I'm really glad you suggested Burke, because it was one of those things that, like, I've been meaning for a very long time to actually get at this kind of source code, to use a really awful analogy itself. And so it was a really fascinating exercise in Burke himself. And I don't know too much about his own biography other than that he was, of course, extremely crusty. But I'm calling something up. He was Anglo-Irish. Is that correct? Like, he was actually So he wasn't what we might call English, although I guess to explain who the Anglo-Irish are, this was a sort of class of persons who were kind of I don't know, you might call them the kind of the native colonial overlords of Ireland at this time, because these were transplanted sort of ethnically and culturally English people who formed the kind of dominant landowner class in Ireland at this time, but had also sort of halfway gone native by the
That's
time of
right. So
Burke.
yeah,
Yeah.
so London would have seen him maybe as a rural rube,
Yeah,
sort of
exactly.
thing,
He
you
would have
know,
been. He would have been
like
something like
their
Iago. He
dumb
would have been.
cousin.
He would have been someone. He would have been someone tainted by his proximity to the Irish, who at this point were subject to some extremely repressive laws that the English had sort of placed over the specifically the Catholic Irish, we should say. So Edmund Burke is interesting in that, and that kind of come from that Anglo-Irish background, in that he's a bit of an outsider to the English themselves. He's a little bit of an outsider to England and France when he's writing his reflections on it. And again, I don't know. I'm not enough of a Burkist to know, and I'm not enough. Of course, I never feel like I have enough knowledge or context about anything
Nah.
to give any kind of definitive statement on anything. But I thought that was an interesting
Okay.
sort of wrinkle as I was reading. But I don't know. I'm blathering on right now. But if Scott, if you could just sort of give us our listeners kind of the rundown of what is the reflections on the revolution in France? Why was it written? And what's kind of the overview here?
I'm going to get on my soapbox for a minute about pedagogy.
Oh,
Like
sure.
you were talking about, you'd read, these secondary sources and these expositions of Burke and so on. And I'm 43, and for some reason I always thought I'd live to 86.
Sure.
So I don't know why, but I always thought I'd live. So I'm halfway done, and there's so many books that I want to read, and I've been led astray so many times that I've resolved that I'm never, ever, ever going to read a book about a book again. If I
That's
see something that, if something jogs my interest or piques my interest, I'm not going to read the secondary source. I'm actually going to go see what Edmund Burke has to say. And a lot of times, secondary sources, we feel like we need those secondary sources to give us some insight or help us. But I think that these great books, like the ones on the list that you guys work from and the Great Books of the Western World list, they're so great that they can meet you where you are. And there's something in this Burke and there's something in this Voltaire for you, no matter who you are. And if you come to Burke clean, you can see him for what he is. He's the father of conservatism. He's often called that. But the word conservative is so poisoned now. And he truly is conservative in that he wants to conserve.
Right. I think
Now,
that's you hit on something there that there we have these labels for certain we have labels that we apply to certain political tendencies and whatnot, and they are applied through a course of time. But that itself is really misleading a lot of the time, because the kinds of ideas that can be represented by this or that label, like there's a thread that can be followed, but also you would be doing yourself and others a massive disservice to assume that some sort of set of policy preferences or tendencies that have that label today match one to one what that label has always meant or what have you. And that's I'm sorry. Yeah, again, I'm kind of blathering now, but yeah,
No, that's
he's
fine.
generally regarded as father of conservatism, and you're right, like because he did want to conserve. He saw in the French Revolution the I get to use it to use a rather a crass colloquialism. He saw the baby going out with the bathwater, so he was interested in
Yes.
talking about, well, what is the baby?
Right. Yeah. The Voltaire book is a firsthand account of what is going on in England at that time, and it's very much about Voltaire. The Burke's book, while it is about Burke, is chock full of fascinating ideas, and there's a lot we could talk about in here. But one of the most interesting things about this is he has educated me about what the English government was at that time. In 1688, they'd had a nasty revolution. Killed their king, brought in a Hanover, a king from, the House of Hanover. And so he's writing about 100 years after this revolution. But the government that he describes in England is essentially maybe the only emergent government left. When I say emergent, like our government is not an emergent government. There were men who sat down with pen and paper,
right,
and designed it out of whole cloth.
They pulled out the compass and the protractor, and they set to work. Yeah,
they designed it, but the government of Berks, England, had evolved slowly since 1066.
Yeah.
And he says, you know, this has emerged because it has utility. It has emerged because it suits us. And he doesn't think it's perfect at all. Mm-hmm. But he says, you know, the wisdom of the ages has gone into this thing. And you best be careful. And then he goes on to make 200 pages of arguments about why you had better handle it carefully.
Right, right.
And I don't think it matters who you are or on what side of any political argument that you stand on. I think Burke's idea of proceeding with caution and Burke's ideas, not his ideas, but his explanation of how high the stakes are if you get it wrong, mm-hmm. are something that everybody really needs to pay attention to.
Yeah. I think that's right. I think that was really one of the most valuable things that I got out of Burke, or rather, you know, an idea that I myself would place a lot of value in that Burke expresses, rather, is that idea of being aware of what the stakes are, being aware of the impacts that will be made on people's material lives, you know, yes. by any sort of given practice or whatnot. And I think, you bring up the Glorious Revolution, the 1688 revolution, which Burke refers to, you know, quite a few times. And I think that was, you know, we note in sort of the popular historiography, like if you've heard of it at all, you've probably heard of it referred to as the Bloodless Revolution. And it was something that everyone was very proud of and whatnot. I think it might have something to do with Burke's Anglo-Irish roots, the fact that, you know, the Bloodless Revolution was anything but bloodless in Ireland. That thing was fought out in Ireland. They had the Jacobite cause. I think they had like open revolt for at least 2 years, sort of desultory actions after that. It led to a total sort of civic collapse. And you had this was also a heyday of highwaymen and highway robbers. So you actually get a lot of the highwaymen ballads are set during this time. So I think it's kind of interesting that what is popularly known as the Bloodless Revolution, Burke is Burke has an awareness of how it was not all that bloodless, and I think that informs his stance of caution, really, in a way that someone, you know, English might not have experienced it that way.
Right. Yeah. And that English that revolution of 1688 that was nasty, and he recognized as nasty, is the very beginning of the American Revolution, in fact, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And he is actually sympathetic to the American cause. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and he has conservative arguments for why the Americans had, should have had self-determination and self-rule. Mm-hmm. And so he's not completely staid. And he does make arguments for how to properly change things, right?
Right, right.
He doesn't just want to pour everything in concrete, cast it in concrete, and we just live out our days with a stodgy government. But I think when I read it, there are a lot of details that one could quibble with, mm-hmm. but just his anti-utopian stance and his caution with change is. I don't know how anybody could disagree with that.
Sure, sure. I think the and this kind of, again, sort of the interesting thing about Burke is one thing that jumped out a little bit at me is a kind of more he did have kind of more of a defense of what we might call. I don't know. And again, you correct me if I'm interpreting this incorrectly or if, you know, if you feel like I'm getting it wrong. It seems like though that he, you know, much more than Voltaire say, even though, you know, Voltaire was suspicious of the more radical democratizing of Great Britain that he was, you know, seeing around that time. But Burke is he's very defensive of the kind of social hierarchy that which is one of the reasons why I think people are surprised that he supported the American independence movement was because at least in rhetoric, the sort of the independence movement, especially with its, you know, leading lights, like say Thomas Paine, really promulgated a much more radical egalitarian vision, of, at least for a particular subset of the residents of the colonies. You know, you're talking about property owning males, basically. But at this, but still, like, it was still a, for the time, a radically egalitarian sort of rhetoric going on, justifying a lot of this stuff that Burke himself, I think, is less bullish on than one might be expected for someone who would support the American War of Independence. So I don't know. What do you think about that reading, Scott? Like, because that's something that I took away from. But I think you've delved more deeply into Burke. You might have something, some perspective on that.
That's true. You know, he's a monarchist, and he's a British. He's an apologist for the British monarchy. And he makes a lot of arguments for why that's the case. It's not just patriotism and blindness that's put in there. But my favorite of these, and the one that was kind of the most compelling to me, is, you know, you get a class of people who have a very, very long-term interest proper stewardship of the country. Mm-hmm. And those are the nobles. They actually have a property right in it, mm-hmm. and their progeny benefit if they do a good job, you know, and so they're trained for it from day one.
Now, I'm not idea, like, of that there is a class of people who are trained to be the sort of leaders of the realm, I guess.
To be the government.
Yeah.
They're trained to govern.
Yeah.
And, you know, he says it's the family business. And if they're, right. and if they're not good at it, they don't get to keep the business. And they've gotten pretty good at it. I'm being flippant here, and he makes a much more eloquent argument than I do, of course. And then here's the kicking one. This is the really good one. He says, "Do you really want to be governed by your peers?" So I'll ask you, podcast listeners. You've been to Walmart.
Yeah,
you've been to Walmart. You want to be governed by your peers?
I mean, some days it's, you know, it seems like the only right way to do things, and then some days you're like, man, I'm glad there are some stop gaps between between us and full on radical democracy. It's an internal struggle.
I've been on Tumblr. Yeah. I've been on Tumblr. I don't want everybody to have a vote.
I mean, I guess I understand the position, man.
And like I said, he makes a 250-page argument there for why that might not be a good idea to be governed by the peers. And but yeah, he is an apologist for the monarchy. Mm-hmm. And again, a lot of the arguments are about the fact that the monarchy that they have, which is a weird hybrid, mm-hmm. at that time they have a parliament, and they control the money, and the king controls, you know, some administrative aspects. It's really this weird thing that's distinctly British, and it emerged over time through necessity. Mm-hmm. And when a necessity arose, the system changed, and they rose to meet the necessity. And he's like, it's pretty good. I don't know that we need to kill 5 to 10% of our population to change this government.
Right. Yeah, I think Voltaire actually had a good line about it in the letters, where I'm paraphrasing because I can't find it right in my notes here, but he said something like, so that, you know, in England, like, the yes, there is a monarch, he is fully empowered to do good, and he is restrained in his capability to do evil. Right. So I think that's kind of that kind of ideal, or rather what Voltaire would see, and think what Burke would see, as this, you know, ideal sort of mode for a monarch, which was again in contrast to the absolutist model, which had been in France, had been established for about 150 years or so by the time the revolution happened, and was considered, you know, at the time to be the wave of the future. it was considered progressive and rationalizing to be centralizing your absolutist monarch power, and of course that didn't quite work out so well for the French, as Burke is happy to point out.
So let me ask you a question. After mm-hmm. reading Burke, yeah. Okay, well, we're here in the United States, and we went to school in the United States, and we're told that democracy and republicanism, you know, Republican democracies, that's the pinnacle of government, mm-hmm. of governmental systems. So after reading Burke, are you satisfied to say that that's as good as it gets.
I wouldn't be satisfied to say that was as good as it gets before I read Burke. And then afterward, though, also like I guess to lay my cards on the table, to use that hoary old phrase again, I am myself a pretty committed egalitarian, you know, in my heart and in my thought. And so I spend a lot of my sort of political energy thinking about ways in which to, I guess, how might a more egalitarian society be responsibly developed? Right. And that's my kind of compass. You know, that's what I go by. And so to that extent, like I don't think I'll ever come around to the Burkean vision altogether. But one thing,
I'm not actually asking about the Burkean.
Vision. Oh, but whether representative democracy is the best we can do?
Yeah, because Burke, for him, this monarchy that they had in England was the analog to the way, you know, most Americans think that American, you know, democracy is. You know, they think that's the pinnacle of, you know, government.
You can't do
any better than that. And, you know, and Burke's like, no. I mean, he said that this is. To me, that was very interesting. You just rarely see anybody. There aren't very many voices out there that aren't Marxist, really. Mm-hmm. And I'm not being slick here.
No, sure.
I mean, that's really the only indictment you hear of our governmental system.
Right, right. And
so
you're right.
You like you get a different indictment. It's interesting.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, and you're right. Like there's this, you're right that one of the very few kind of actual, you know, systematic appraisals of, you know, a current like little d liberal democracy does come from, you know, a Marxist analytical perspective or a leftist analytical perspective. And so it does seem, yeah, I think you're right. It was very interesting and very instructive to get a critique of that system from a different perspective. It's the kind of primary source reading that that I think lends itself best to, I don't know, to generating a sort of, to creating in yourself a kind of vigorous and rigorous thinker, I guess is what I'm trying to say. You've had a conversation with me, Scott. You know that I can ramble on at times while I'm trying to discover the point that I'm trying to make. but I guess what I am trying to say is that I would not be willing to stake out, you know, on my life that the representative democracy as currently constituted in most of the what we know of as the little d liberal democracies is the best possible political arrangement. I guess the real question is, you know, what's the responsible way to find something that would be better? And I think the Burkean, I think that's the great value in the Burkean ethos, is that kind of...
I think Burke would tell you, I don't know, but you better go slow and easy.
Exactly. That's exactly
it. Or people are going to get hurt.
That's exactly what I was going to say. That's, I think, the real value in the Burkean analysis is this, you know, at every point, bear in mind, you're talking about real people's lives, real people's material existence. So whatever you're talking about, you better make damn sure you cross your T's and dot your I's.
You know, when I talked to Claude about this, you know, he said that he thought that Burke, okay, the French Revolution is a very rational project of the Enlightenment, right? It was born out of theory, right? There were these theoretical rights of men that they had discussed, and you know, people had different ways of deriving those theoretical rights of men, and depending on which rights those you settled on, kind of might direct the direction of the revolution. So it's all theory. It's all heady. It's all up in your head, you know? Mm-hmm. And Claude's like, you know, Burke is making this personal. He said he's putting affect into this.
Yeah.
You know, he's pointing out that when you make these changes, real people get hurt.
Yeah.
And I hadn't read that way, but I think Claude's exactly right.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't think on the face of it, especially with, you know, how Burke is portrayed popularly, that he would be the face of this sort of, this sort of empathetic view. You know, but he is.
Yeah.
And Rousseau might not be.
Right. Like, yeah, I think you're right that it's almost a kind of, it's almost a kind of historical irony that Burke can be claimed as a founder by certain strains of thought that that tend not to value this idea of compassion and empathy in political terms. Because I think, and you know, as always, all of these books, all of these ideas are much more complicated and much more nuanced than anyone telling you what they said is going to be. And I think right there, you've hit upon the real value in actually engaging with these works. And I think right there, I think we hit upon the real, hey man, that's the root that we have in common with our two projects here. I think that's a good place to wrap it up. Go out and read for yourselves, see for yourselves, people. And so if you're a listener to The Cannonball, or if you're listening to any of the fine podcasts on Agora Podcast Network, you are someone who is curious about the world. You're someone who is curious about their fellow citizens, about the society they live in. Dive deep, man. Grab those foundational texts by the horns. Read them for yourself. And I can't really think of a better way to get started on that and to provide yourself with the structure to do it than online great books. So Scott, thank you so much for having this conversation with us. And I tell everyone again, what's the best way to, it's just onlinegreatbooks.com. Is that correct? Just that's the URL.
That is the one. That's right. Okay. There you go. And you can sign up. If nothing else, go on the VIP waiting list. We'll send you a digest of our reading list, but you've got to read these books, the books that you guys are talking about here on Cannonball, mm-hmm. the books that we talk about, most of the same books. They are great books for a lot of reasons. And one of them is they're actually, If they weren't written so well and if they weren't so beautiful, they wouldn't have made it. People copied these books down by hand, by candlelight, on dead sheep, so that you and I could have them. You know, it was a lot of work for Plato to get to us.
Yeah.
Thousands and tens of thousands of man hours for him to get to us. Yeah. And the reason they went through that effort is because he was worth it.
Yeah.
And if you don't read it, if you watch Game of Thrones instead of reading one of these, you're crapping on those monks who copied that by hand so that you right. can have it.
there's always the balance to be struck. I mean, for me, like, you know, yes, I am reading these great books for The Cannonball, but I also got to have my trash. But yeah, man, I think it's part of what's cool about online great books is that you provide that that structure to help people fit it all in with everything. That's just 3 hours of reading a week. Yeah, and anybody can really do that. I think that's terrific. But yeah, but remember, y'all, if you go and you sign up, use the promo code CAN to get 25% off, and that also helps support us over here at The Cannonball so that we can get Josh a really nice present for Producer's Day. But it's
when's
just
Producer's Day.
It probably is at some point. I'll have to look it up.
Every day's
Producer's Day. We love Josh that much. But yeah, thank you so much, Scott. This has been a really fantastic conversation, and I'll see everybody on The Cannonball, and y'all please check out Online Great Books.
Thanks.